frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on February 10th, 2019, for air on February 12th and 19th, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Nate joined me to discuss the Sackler family's role in creating the opioid crisis and the Massachusetts Attorney General's lawsuit against them. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio again this week is Nate. Hi, Nate.
Hey, Bill.
And on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Nate.
Okay, so we're talking this week and repeating the episode the following week as well. So it might have been the previous week's episode if you're listening to this on the second time. But anyway, the topic this week is about the Sackler family and the opioid crisis, their role in it, and the Massachusetts lawsuit in the state, you know, by the state government in Massachusetts against this family for their role in the crisis. Massachusetts has been one of the hard hit places in particular, and this is certainly, you know, where Nate and I live, so, you know, it's of particular interest to us. Nate, can you talk to us a little bit first about this lawsuit?
Yeah, so Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey filed this lawsuit recently alleging the Sackler family, which controls Purdue Pharma, engage in frequent acts of deception and misconduct to make as much money as possible, even as OxyContin sparked the nation's opioid crisis and its staggering toll of addiction and death, coming from the Washington Post there. So, I mean, this is nothing new. There's been the opioid crisis now for what feels like years now, and there's now been some pointing of the fingers to sort of the big pharma companies that are actually pushing out these pills and marketing them and convincing doctors to prescribe them in ways and quantities that are perhaps not advisable if you do not want to become addicted and die. So, you know, that's sort of what's finally happening here, it looks like. And now it seems like emails are coming out where, you know, you have the heads of the companies, Richard Sackler, or he's former president of Purdue, but he's personally directing sales representatives to push extremely high dosages, even though that a lot of the doctors knew that it would put patients at greater risk, like personally selecting the doctors, including some here in Massachusetts that have like they prescribe more often than was necessary. And then there's all sorts of interesting things in this in these emails that Purdue fought to release a lot of the sections of the 274-page complaint. But apparently at one point they were trying to like distance themselves from statistics and studies that showed the addictive characteristics of OxyContin. They were approving public marketing plans that labeled people hurt by opioids as just junkies and criminals. Sackler wrote that Purdue should hammer the critics in every way possible. Another point, they brought in McKinsey Consulting to just talk about how, oh, actually, opioids reduce stress and bring you out of social isolation, which is, of course, nonsense. So basically, it seems like they were just running this sham operation, and it now seems like the government is going to go after them, but we'll see sort of what happens from there.
Rachel, you wanted to talk about some of the other aspects of this emerging scandal?
So in the documents, the it talked about the specific marketing and targeting of groups of patients. So the elderly for arthritis example, because there was a revenue stream because Medicare could foot the bill, veterans as well, because they were part of the VA system that would help them pay for these drugs. And they also targeted what they described to be opioid naive prescribers who could be subject or particularly vulnerable to their marketing ploys. I wanted to point out that it's extremely easy to get addicted to these substances. And it's interesting to see if you've ever had like a surgery or any sort of procedure, just how many prescription painkillers like you'll be given. I broke my arm in an accident, and I think I got 3 different opioid painkillers. I got oxycodone, hydrocodone, and I think some third one that I can't really remember. But I think I got like 6 dozen pills in total. So it's just really easy to see. If I had used them to the end of their prescription as directed, I could have probably easily become addicted or physically dependent on those painkillers.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people's stories of how a family member, you know, who ended up dying from overdosing or something on heroin, you know, how did they get involved in that? Well, it usually started out with like, oh, they broke their arm or something, you know, and got a bunch of RX.
Or like, you know, they were hurt their back working or something. It's a work-related injury, and then they just get hooked there, so...
And you know, to that point, Rachel, that you were bringing up about targeting these sort of naive prescribers, like a lot of the sort of reaction to this crisis and the legislative response and executive orders in various states has been targeting the, you know, doctors and accusing them of being pill mills. And, you know, no doubt about it. Certainly plenty of doctors did play that role. But as a lot of this documentation has shown, it's not just like it was completely just, oh, these doctors went rogue and decided to make a bunch of extra money. It was also that a lot of them were being very explicitly targeted by these, like, you know, sales teams to try to get them to be pushing these as well. So it was coming from the corporate level and not just, it wasn't just, you know, individual doctors making bad decisions, you know, to make
right.
a buck.
Yeah, I think there's a long form article on Esquire.com. And I think it's really good at going into the history of how this problem came to be. And I think in the early 90s, when OxyContin first came out, they would hold these like quote unquote conferences where they would basically pay for doctors to go to resorts with like golf courses and beaches, private beaches and whatnot. And they would just basically give them the hard sell. Also, they would promise lucrative speaking fees, so they would kind of hire you onto their like coterie of speakers that would go to these conferences, and they would get speaking fees for telling other doctors about how great OxyContin is. So it was just kind of an organized payout system to bribe doctors into prescribing more OxyContin to their patients.
And then, of course, you know, they weren't just making money off of creating the problem. They were also making money off of trying to, quote unquote, solve the problem. One of the things in the lawsuit noted, which I don't know if you mentioned this already, Nate, but that the, you know, that they were also making some of the addiction treatment drugs and then saying that their own internal like projections show that 40-60% of the patients buying Suboxone, for example, for the first time would relapse and have to take it again, which meant more revenue. Like, so it was coming and going both ends, you know, creating the problem and then solving the problem, but also solving it in a way that was bad and made them more money. Right.
Yeah. That was definitely part of it. And you know, then there's also been this whole debate over Suboxone and Narcan, and people are trying to limit its usage too. So it's just sort of a let them die type situation. But as you mentioned, that they're trying to get the money from curing people, but it's also in some cases not sufficient and they need to double up. Or so going back to the lawsuit for a second, apparently this is sort of a consolidation of a number of lawsuits, because of course there's been many, many lawsuits brought against these companies by various states, individuals, and I think some Native American tribes. And there is sort of a consolidation. I think a lot of the other lawsuits are in Ohio federal court, but I think these proceedings are probably going to be going on for a long time. And as we mentioned, or as we were talking about before the show, there were lawsuits against Purdue and Sackler going back to mid-2000s for misrepresenting the addictive potential of OxyContin. And that's sort of even before this whole quote-unquote opioid crisis has been really going, where you've seen a lot of deaths and things like that.
Rachel?
So I just wanted to point out that the treatment of chronic pain kind of has a long and fraught history that kind of led us to where we are today. In 1986, two doctors from Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital in New York published a fateful article in a medical journal that purported to show, based on a study of 38 patients, that long-term opioid treatment was safe and effective so long as patients had no history of drug abuse. So that kind of became widely cited in this quest to bring more painkillers to patients. I don't know what your scientific background is, but a study with an N of 38 doesn't sound very sound statistically. So that less than 1% risk of addiction from long-term opioid use has kind of been widely disseminated as a reason for prescribing large amounts of opioids to chronic pain patients. But in 2016, the CDC issued a warning saying there was no good evidence that opioids were an effective treatment for chronic pain beyond 6 weeks. So I think the medical community is trying to turn the tide, but there's been a solid 30 years of bad science with poor reproducibility, poor study structuring. So I think it's going to take a while to kind of fight against this overprescribing and of painkillers for chronic pain. I hope Maura Healey is successful in her quest to kind of bring Big Pharma, this huge pharmaceutical company, to justice.
Yeah. Going back, Bill, you mentioned a bit about the savings card situation. Almost couldn't even believe it that there would be something like that. But as part of the lawsuit, patients who use Purdue's discount cards are more likely to get hooked on OxyContin. Coming from WBUR here, unsuspecting patients on the painkiller OxyContin did not know their chances of becoming addicted increased significantly when they used a drug maker's prescription discount card. They created the OxyContin savings card so people could stay on the drug longer for longer periods of time, which resulted in higher rates of addiction and more overdoses. And this is coming from part of the lawsuit. Internal Purdue documents reveal that people on savings card remained on OxyContin longer and produced especially, quote, high returns for the Sacklers, the suit alleges. So, I mean, that would make sense. If they're getting a little bit of a discount, they're going to continue using probably beyond the recommended, Rachel, as you mentioned, what was it, 6 weeks?
Yeah.
And I mean, at that point, you would think that unless you have some sort of really serious condition or something, a lot of a post-surgery or post-injury pain might be gone by that point, and you could switch over to other methods. And I think hasn't there been some research that have found that in a lot of cases, Tylenol will also work in comparison to some of these, long-time pain opioids and things like that. So, I mean, obviously for surgery and things like that, they're going to still continue to use high dose, various types of medicine. But at the same time, that's not really what you give out for these chronic pain issues. So,
yeah, I just wanted to recommend a book called Dreamland by Sam Quinones. It really dives deep into the history of the treatment of chronic pain in the United States. In the 80s and 90s, when this kind of started fomenting, chronic pain wasn't seen as it was more situational. Like if you had cancer or a terminal illness, that's when you got prescriptions for opioids. And in the 80s and 90s, pain management became this venerated branch of medicine, despite the fact that studies found that a holistic approach examining the lifestyle of chronic pain patients and alternative treatments, such as diet and exercise and physical therapy, was much, much more effective at treating chronic pain issues. However, our system is built on this for-profit insurance system, and treating chronic pain in a holistic manner is unfortunately very expensive, whereas throwing pills at the problem is a much cheaper, easier, more efficient market-based solution. So our current health system is definitely a factor in why this opioid crisis has exploded to the extent that it has.
And they don't seem to have much of a profit incentive to come up with non-addictive things. Because even if you set aside stuff like diet, exercise, physical therapy and stuff, like, it is true that we're not very good, you know, in terms of innovations in pain management at the actual treatment of the pain. But, you know, they don't seem to have an incentive to come up with a non-addictive, more effective drug, because people are not going to buy as much of it because they're not as addicted. And, you know, despite their internal documents saying, oh, we should really emphasize that the people, the addicts, are just, you know, junkies and criminals who succumbed to the base instincts or whatever, and they should have had the willpower to resist the addictiveness. Like, they knew what they were doing, and they knew that this was addictive, and they knew that they were going to make a lot more money off of it being addictive. I mean, it's like, you know, the cigarette companies or the vaping companies or whatever, like, knowing that they're selling an addictive product, they're not going to be like, well, how do we make this less addictive? Like, that's how you make money hand over fist, is by having something that's addictive that people become physically or mentally dependent on, and they have to buy more of it.
I think it's also worth talking a bit about some recent protest actions that have been as a result of not this lawsuit, but the notoriety of the Sackler family. They've been splashing their money around and getting their name on various sort of public institutions and various museums and stuff. So their name is on part of the Guggenheim Museum now, American Museum of Natural History, London's Victoria and Albert Museum, where they just opened the Sackler Courtyard, attended by the Duchess of Cambridge. There's a Sackler wing of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And this has led to a large amount of protests about it. Last year, a lot of people, dozens of protesters, tossed pill bottles inside, calling it a temple of greed. And then just recently, there was a large protest at the Guggenheim, where I believe there was a like a multimedia visual art wing or something that the Sacklers had donated to. And then you just had people raining down these leaflets, basically showing the amount of dead that Sackler has led to, and, you know, writing prescriptions down on there and, you know, writing some of his quotes down on there. We have to hammer on the abusers in every way possible. They are the culprits of the problem. They are the reckless criminals. And they were making it rain there in the Guggenheim. So,
and this sort of is a good illustration of the problem with, you know, philanthropy by multimillionaires and billionaires, is that they're trying to buy their way out of these sort of problems and shield themselves from criticism, and then also make a lot of institutions, as many as possible, dependent on their sort of financial largesse, so that they will be reluctant to call it out or, you know, stand in solidarity with anyone else. You know, in particular, you know, kind of repugnant to have art museums funded by this, because, you know, like, we know that a lot of, you know, artists certainly struggle with various addiction issues. And, like, this is sort of, you know, a slap in the face of that. But, you know, that's why taxation is the better way to go on funding these things. Having government programs to fund various, you know, museums and artists and so forth is always going to be the better way to go than this, you know, philanthropy by billionaires and millionaires, because you can just say, well, however you got the money, we're going to take it in the form of taxation, and then we're going to put it toward these causes, but you're not going to get your name all over it. And of course, they don't like that. So,
yeah. And I think also another dangerous thing is they've been pushing their sort of curriculum in universities. So they gave a lot of money to Tufts and Tufts Medical School. And I think as a result of that, Tufts was, like, basically teaching like their curriculum, like, basically prescribe as many Sackler approved Purdue Pharma painkillers as you want. And so that's kind of contributed to the situation there. And we've seen this in a lot of other areas, not just pharmaceutical, but, you know, oil, natural gas. They're giving money to various colleges and universities. So they're creating a situation where you have people that basically downplay the risk of climate change and things like that, or basically say it's not happening or we shouldn't worry about it. And we're seeing a similar situation here.
I just wanted to highlight that one of the main organizers of these protests, Nan Golden, she said she actually was addicted to opioids. In 2014, she was described OxyContin for painful tendonitis in her left wrist. She promptly became addicted despite taking the pills exactly as prescribed. So she said, the first time I got a script, it was 40 milligrams and it was too strong for me. They made me nauseated and dulled. By the end, I was on 450 milligrams a day, she says. Eventually, she was crushing and snorting them. When, back in New York, doctors refused to supply her anymore, she turned to the black market and to cheaper, hard street drugs whenever she ran out of money. So this highlights the kind of black market issues as well, and the fact that heroin has seen a resurgence because once you can't find pills through these pill mills, you quickly seek out alternative sources, and heroin is oftentimes cheaper and easier to acquire than the pills even.
Right, as we've seen oftentimes mixed or adulterated with fentanyl, and then the dosage is not regulated or secured, mm-hmm. so that's lead to deaths and things like that. So
yeah, and The Guardian actually spoke with somebody that witnessed the protests at the Guggenheim, and he was visiting from Manchester, New Hampshire, which has been severely affected by the opioids crisis, and he actually said that his brother-in-law died from opioid addiction. He died of a mix of heroin and fentanyl. So even if you're just a random bystander at a museum, chances are you've been touched by the opioid crisis because it has affected so many people in our country.
Yeah, and I think I've heard other people say this, but we're now reaching the point where, like, everybody knows somebody who has had this affect their life. Either, you know, they died because of it, or they were addicted for a while and managed to get treatment or something, or they're still addicted. And there was some more at the actual hearing at the courthouse down in the Seaport District here in Boston. You had people come and talk about their experiences and how they've lost children. Rhonda Lottie from Watertown said her daughter Maria died after an overdose at age 19 back in 2011. She said, I'm really hopeful that the truth is finally going to come out. The Purdue and Sacklers, are no longer going to be able to hide behind their attorneys and their money while we live with the losses of our loved ones. And then Healy met with them after the meeting or whatever and said, these families have had to endure so much in terms of stigma. It's really rich for this corporate defendant and the corporate officers and directors to come forward and, under the guise of embarrassment or shame about their alleged misconduct, to claim that this information shouldn't come to light, because they were trying to block some of the disclosure there. So.
And although certainly in Massachusetts, as we mentioned earlier, that it's been a particularly hard hit state in this current crisis of the past, you know, 5 or so years, and everyone here definitely at this point knows someone who's, you know, been affected by it. It is also important to note that there were some parts of the United States where this was kicked off as early as the 90s and was sort of a testing ground for a lot of the policies that subsequently went nationwide. You know, and I haven't so far seen stuff about that in the lawsuit, but you know, I think that a lot of folks in West Virginia who have any sort of national profile have talked about that they feel frustrated that, you know, it took so long for this to become a national problem that people wanted to address nationally when it was ravaging the state of West Virginia for, you know, decades before this really kicked off. And, the, you know, not just the heroin and the fentanyl and stuff, but also just the Oxy itself and things like that. And there were a lot of people who were really struggling and not getting any sort of support, certainly not from the state government and not from the federal government, because the federal government just didn't consider it important enough. And, you know, this
Florida was also hit pretty hard.
Yeah. And of course, then the sort of response that sprang up in Florida was all these sort of, you know, scammy for-profit recovery clinics and rehab centers that weren't really interested in helping people recover. They were really just interested in, you know, taking people's misery and turning that into profit as well by getting them to, you know, out of desperation, come and, you know, either give their personal savings over or, you know, scam Medicaid in various institutions. I think we might have even talked about that on the show previously, but there's various sort of Medicare and Medicaid related scams and people like changing their addresses to Florida and stuff like that so that they can go to these clinics, which again, don't seem to have any actual effectiveness in terms of getting people the help that they need. It's just yet another way of somebody making money off of the crisis that was originally created by some people trying to make enormous boatloads of money that they didn't need to be making. Any closing thoughts, Rachel?
Yeah, your last point shows just how nefarious it was that they targeted these marginalized groups, because then they couldn't get a spotlight on their issues and help bring this issue to the forefront in a timely manner, because they were like on the margins of society. So West Virginia and Florida are common places that are just kind of the butt of a joke for people, because poor and marginalized people live there. So it's very frustrating to look back at that and see how people were shouting about this issue and just weren't being taken seriously.
Yeah, and I think the real difference is once the rich white kids started to die, then that's when the national media attention is going to come and the real concern is going to get going. When it's, you know,
when it spread into the suburbs that Nate and I grew up into is when it became a national emergency.
And I mean, we saw some of that firsthand too. I mean, it definitely existed, and then you'd hear other stories and things like that. So, but yeah, I mean, that's obviously the main difference. You know, if overdoses are being isolated to poor black communities or poor and rural white communities, that's very different than, you know, at these pretty expensive suburbs and things like that. And then all of a sudden it's striking in that situation. So that's probably the reason for increased media attention over the past couple of years, but it's definitely been going on for a while now. So,
all right. Reminder, we will not have an episode next week. If you're listening to this on the first week it airs, this is going to repeat for a second week, and then we'll be back after that. Nate, thanks for being here in studio this week.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Rachel.
Rachel, thanks for being on the line.
Thanks, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.